Welcome to the O'Reilly Data Show. I'm your host, Ben Lorica. On today's episode, I'll be chatting with my friend David Bly, a professor of computer science and statistics at Columbia University. David has done a lot of things, but he's famous for being one of the co-creators of topic models, a popular text mining technique. I hope you enjoyed the show. Welcome to the O'Reilly Data Show. Today, I'm with my friend David Bly, who's a computer science and statistics professor at Columbia, and he's known as one of the creators of topic models. And we'll, in this episode, we'll talk a lot about topic models. And I thought that to start off, David, maybe you can just give a high-level description of what topic models are, particularly for some people who are not technical or may not have heard of it before.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on the show. Excited to be here. Yeah, the basic idea behind topic models is that, you know, we have access right now to massive collections of online documents, online information. And this was true a decade ago when we started working on this, and it's even, it's even more pressing now. And with this unprecedented access to massive document collections, we need new ways to automatically organize and annotate them so that we can search and understand and browse and explore and take advantage of what that kind of access gives us. Right now we work with online documents mainly using things like search and links that we get, say, from social media. We type some words into Google and we get a set of documents back, or we log on to Twitter and we see some links to documents that other people that we like are pointing us to. And then we look at these documents, navigating to other linked documents, for example. What topic modeling does is it involves a different vision for how we can explore and navigate this kind of digitized information. In this vision, basically, you can search and explore a collection of documents based on the underlying themes that run through them. So, for example, you might take the entire collection of the New York Times through history, and a topic model can identify that what themes ran through the New York Times, and then give you access to the New York Times through those themes. So you could zoom in and zoom out to find specific or broader themes. This is in the vision for topic modeling. You can look at how a certain theme like technology might have changed over time. You can see how themes are connected to each other, how they relate to each other. And so rather than finding documents through keyword search by itself or through links, you can find a pattern, a theme that you're interested in, and then examine the documents related to that theme. That's the vision for topic modeling. Of course, the main point is that these massive collections of documents, we don't know what the themes are. And so topic modeling algorithms analyze huge collections, identify the themes automatically, and then annotate the documents according to those themes so that we can explore and search and understand. So, and this is, of course, a activity that we don't have the human power to do, to annotate all of the world's collection that's now online. So that's the basic idea behind topic modeling.
So it sounds like from your description that you have an algorithm, and the end result is it helps people make sense and navigate massive amounts of probably unstructured text.
That's right. That's right.
It sounds like user interface and some kind of UI is critical to making this consumable by people.
Yeah, so there's one more thing I'd like to add, actually. So that was our vision for topic modeling in the very beginning, that, you know, we want to analyze, like you said, unstructured texts and organize them automatically so that people can understand what's in them. You know, you can imagine you're a lawyer and you've just been handed 500,000 emails for a case. How do you find what you're looking for in those emails when you don't even know what's in them in the first place? Topic model can help visualize and summarize and help us navigate those texts. But there's an aside, which is that when you use these kinds of algorithms to understand and analyze texts, you obtain these representations of the documents in terms of which of these discovered topics they represent. So you might analyze a bunch of New York Times articles, for example, and there'll be an article about sports and business, and you get a representation of that article that says, this is an article and it's about sports and business. Okay, and now, of course, the ideas of sports and business were also discovered by the algorithm, but that representation, it turns out, is also useful for prediction. So my understanding when I go and speak to people at different startup companies and other more established companies is that a lot of technology companies are using topic modeling to generate this representation of documents in terms of the discovered topics, and then using that representation in other algorithms for things like classification or other things.
I see. So, but still, it seems like that the when I see topic models and the results of topic models, the ones that really attract a lot of the attention, there's usually a slick user interface attached to it. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So certainly, right, that is a main application. Though they are, like I mentioned, used under the hood as this kind of feature generation as well. But yes, you're right.
Right. So that's great. So I always like to talk to people who created this stuff. And luckily, you're the creator
of the original algorithm.
So let's take a step back and talk about how this whole space emerged to begin with. So obviously there were techniques in place for navigating and making sense of unstructured text at around the time that you guys published that seminal paper on the latent Dirichlet allocation. Mm-hmm. By the way, what year was that paper?
The longer article came out in 2003. We wrote a shorter article I think it was published in 2001. We started working on this in 1999.
So what was the genesis of the project? Was it a class or was it?
Sure. Yeah. Well. So the big problem we were trying to solve is how do you take big collections of unstructured text and extract meaning from them automatically with an algorithm. And you know, there's the seminal work, the prior seminal work here is something called latent semantic analysis, also called latent semantic indexing. And this came out of cognitive psychology from some amazing scholars, Tom Landauer and Susan Dumay, among others. Susan Dumay's at Microsoft Research. And latent semantic indexing introduced to the world the idea that if we organize documents as a matrix where rows are documents and columns are terms in a vocabulary, and each cell is the count of how many times that term appeared in that document or some function of that count, we organize into a matrix, then we can analyze that matrix to extract what look like themes from document collections. Okay, so it turned that problem of extracting meaning into a linear algebra problem, basically. It's called latent semantic analysis. And that work was done in the 80s and then in the 90s. And it's had a huge impact. Now, who was using
latent semantic analysis when you guys came to the scene? Was it even computer scientists were?
Yeah, computer scientists had been analyzing it, and it was used to some degree to explore texts, but also as to help classify texts. It was used in automatic essay grading, for example, and it still is. It's still a very important idea and algorithm. But I think of that if there is a single idea that launched this whole area, you know, it was latent semantic analysis. So then there was a fellow, Thomas Hoffman. He was actually a postdoc with my advisor, Mike Jordan. And he worked on something called probabilistic latent semantic analysis. And what that was a way of embedding latent semantic analysis into a kind of statistical model. And that's really the direct predecessor to LDA. And I can talk a little bit about the relationship between them in a bit, although it's a little technical.
Wait a minute. So for our technical readers, listeners, I mean, what kinds of new avenues and problems did the PLSA open up?
Right. So LSA, we'll talk about LSA more technically, is a linear algebra procedure. Right? We're gonna take this matrix and we're going to factorize it. And it showed that factorization had some good properties, but it's hard to think about data in terms of a factorization sometimes, not necessarily, but it's not as natural as thinking about something like a probability model. So what Thomas Hoffman did was built a probability model of counts, of word counts, kind of piggybacking off of language modeling, but also using ideas from latent semantic analysis. And he showed that from that you can get things like topics out of text. So you can analyze documents with the algorithms that he proposed for working with this probability model that he developed, and get things like topics out of the of these collections. And so that it was very exciting. So suddenly you could think about working with that model, which directly analyzed counts, rather than trying to think about a matrix factorization as some proxy for meaning. It's an aside, but you know, without even knowing that I was watching the problem that I would be working on for many years, at least 15 years now, I was at the conference where he first presented PLSI, and I saw his talk. That was the ICHGAI conference in 1999 in Stockholm. And that's where the paper appeared, Thomas Hoffman's paper appeared. And I was there because I had a workshop paper about something related to robotics. It had to do with my undergraduate thesis.
Oh, interesting.
And so I remember his talk. I remember seeing it, and I remember liking it. But of course, you know, I had no idea that that's what I would be working on. So yeah, I saw that talk. Anyway, that was in the late 90s. And then, you know, the kind of long version of this story is that, you know, I read that paper and I liked it, and I was excited about text. I just started at Berkeley as a graduate student. And I went into the summer internship at Compaq Research, which was in Boston. And I worked with a researcher there named Pedro Moreno, a great guy. And what he wanted to do was take the output of speech recognition applied to radio shows. So imagine you take a radio show, you run a speech recognizer on it. He wanted to take the output of that and segment it automatically. So he wanted to segmented into the stories, right? You listen to All Things Considered or whatever, right, and there's 10 different stories, and you could imagine taking All Things Considered, putting it through a speech recognizer, getting some kind of noisy signal about what words were said, and then you want to find the moments in the radio broadcast where the story changed. And this is a real problem, an interesting problem, and a worthwhile one if you're going to take big archives of radio programs and somehow let people search them and index them. And so we were trying to solve that problem. And I had just read about PLSI. Summer of 2000 I was there. And I had just read about PLSI, and we discussed embedding it in a time series model and building on it to solve this problem. And we worked on that. And so I got into the details of how to fit these kinds of models and understood something about their behavior. So maybe this is too long.
It sounds like that work was definitely a much more applied and practical, right? So you were an intern, you were probably cranking out code, is that correct?
Oh yeah, no, I implemented PLSI, and then I improved on it and implemented this time series version. And we wrote a paper about it as well. It came out in SIGIR in 2001.
Then you come back to Berkeley all fired up.
Right, so then I came back to Berkeley, and my office mate was Andrew Ng. So he and I were both students of Mike Jordan. He was a senior student. I was just starting out. It was my second year. And Andrew said, you know, how was your summer? We went out for coffee. Everyone in Berkeley hangs out at this coffee shop called Brood Awakening. It's on Euclid. And basically, we spent all our time in that coffee shop. And we went out for coffee. And Andrew said, you know, how was your summer? I said, it was good. You know, I worked on PLSI. And Andrew said, huh, you know, something's always kind of bothered me about PLSI. And I know this sounds like, you know, one of those stories, but he took out a napkin and he drew a picture of something called the topic simplex. And the sort of key difference between LDA and PLSI has to do with the topic simplex. He drew this picture and he kind of illustrated what PLSI means on the topic simplex. And then he illustrated an alternative idea. And our fleshing out that alternative idea and understanding what it means and understanding how to work with it and then understanding its implications, that's topic modeling. So it really, you know, Andrew Ng really started it on this napkin at Brood Awakening.
So you guys fleshed it out, wrote the paper. What was the initial reaction to the paper?
So, well, then there was Mike Jordan was teaching a class on graphical models, So I worked on LDA as my final project for that class. Mike and Andrew and I worked on it together. And We wrote a paper, appeared at the NIPS conference. It's a big machine learning conference, an excellent conference. And the reaction was, I guess, fine. It was a paper. It didn't garner a lot of attention, but people were interested in it. I remember Thomas Hoffman came by the poster where I was presenting it, and I was very nervous to be presenting an improvement on his work to him. You know, he was a famous guy, and I was a graduate student. But yeah, you know, it went well. It was a good kind of first paper for me, or it was like my second paper.
You know, for my end, my first encounter probably was years later, because it was when you already had that C program out.
Yeah.
With the Python utilities. By that time, but even then, though, David, even then, at that time, I felt like I was at the cutting edge, because many people in industry had not really been using it yet.
Yeah, yeah. So when it really got legs was a little later on. So after that first paper, we had an algorithm for fitting the model in that first paper that it was pretty complicated. It involved Newton's method for
this
something.
It's a variational base approach, right?
Yeah. So we've always been doing variational inference here, variational base or variational inference. But our first algorithm for LDA, it wasn't very efficient. And in between that first small conference paper and the 2003 paper, the latent Dirichlet allocation paper, which is the one that's become very well known and is built on, we realized a much better way to fit the model. And so then, you know, after that, we wrote this much longer paper, and that's really with many
more examples from what I remember, right? Not just text.
That's right. We applied it to collaborative filtering in that paper. And over the following years, we started working with this idea in a lot of different contexts, with scientific texts, with news, with images, with bringing different kinds of information together. And, you know, for me personally, and this is how it relates to my current research, LDA was my entry into using probability modeling as a language for describing assumptions about data, and then using inference algorithms as a way to compute under those assumptions, squaring the model and the data. And it became a palette for me for building new kinds of data science methods to solve new kinds of problems. And versus PLSI, so this is this technical distinction I want to make. The difference between LDA and PLSI is that what I did with, for example, with Pedro, embellishing PLSI to a time series, this is much easier with LDA. LDA has some statistical properties that make it much easier to embed in larger, more complicated models. And that's why it has spawned all of these extensions. And that's why it's used in all of these other methods that you really compose LDA with other kinds of things, like hidden Markov models or Kalman filters or hierarchical models or other kinds of data. This is what it launched also from in my own intellectual journey.
By the way, there was another paper. I don't know if you feel the same way, but from the outside, it seemed like there was that paper that used Markov chain Monte Carlo.
Yes, that's Tom Griffith's paper. Yeah.
Yeah, and that seemed to
Griffiths
also
and Stivers.
That also seemed to attract new converts, right?
Yes, that did. That's an excellent paper. It's an excellent algorithm, the MCMC algorithm. I mean, really, the model and the algorithm are separate. So that Tom's paper is about the same model, LDA, but it's a different inference algorithm. And they did a beautiful job of explaining the model and also explaining how this algorithm works and why it finds topics. And that paper appeared in PNAS, which is a very high-profile journal in it. And they read a lot of interest, also especially among cognitive scientists, came up in that paper. And Tom is a close colleague of mine. And we at that time started working together. After he wrote that paper, he and I started talking, and we worked together on several other papers.
Now, how soon before you start hearing that people out in the wild and in industry are using it? So certainly we had some success stories at O'Reilly. We applied it to a bunch of projects, consulting projects. You know, in a consulting project, it's really at the end of the day, can you convince your client about the results and your recommendations? And it seemed like using this technique, we were able to do that in several occasions.
Yeah. So, you know, I wonder when I first heard about its impact in industry. You know, I know it's definitely, we wrote that paper and it got a lot of attention. And And then we started writing all different kinds of, building all different kinds of extensions to LDA for different kinds of data. And also at that same time, we got interested in Bayesian nonparametrics, which is the kind of topic models where they're, where you learn the number of topics as part of the algorithm, which is a separate thread of research. And at first, you know, in academia, others started building on LDA. And in the beginning, I kind of was aware, you know, I had worked on this originally.
Well, by the way, you had that program sitting out in your server in Princeton. Were you tracking the number of downloads?
I wasn't, no. Yeah. I should have.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if there was a, there were certain periods where it just spiked.
I guess it lives in the log files. We could somehow go and get that. But yeah, and I really have Mike Jordan to thank for releasing that software. He strongly encouraged me to do it. And he said, you know, you should release the software for this model. And I thought, you know, I kind of want to work on these other things that I'm working on. Mike said, go, you know, it makes sense to do it. And I think that that is one of the reasons why it took off.
You were answering questions in the mailing list.
That's right. So there was this piece of software out there, and I used to get a lot of emails about with questions about how to use it and what does the output mean and things like that. And so I created this little mailing list called the Topic Modeling Mailing List at Princeton. And I used to work at Princeton before I came here to Columbia. And that was created so that I could answer these questions all at once, right? So many people could benefit from the answers to those questions. But that mailing list now has turned into a mailing list for the topic modeling community. And I think it has something like 1,000 people on it. And so it's this that mailing list now has archives where there's lots of answers to questions about topic modeling. We answer questions about the software. People ask other research kind of questions about what's possible with topic modeling. Is there a topic model to do X, Y, or Z? It's really become a nice community. That was unexpected. Yeah, I guess that was another. So releasing the software and also making that mailing list, these were important pieces. But to get back to your question, you know, right. So at first, there was academic interest, and I started seeing papers that were extending LDA, for example, to computer vision or to audio signal or to or with other kinds of or with Markov assumptions, with assumptions that the words aren't exchangeable but rather have a time series to them. And, you know, it was funny. I remember at first I was aware of all the different extensions, and then at some point that changed and I no longer could keep my hand on everything, right? I couldn't know about all the different topic modeling papers that were out there. And so I get asked a lot of questions. Hey, has anybody written a paper about this or this? And I usually have to answer, you know, I'm not sure. I know what my students are up to, and when something has a lot of traction, of course I know about it. But at some point I lost my own handle of the topic modeling literature because it was growing so fast. And at the same time, I started hearing about people using topic modeling in industry. You know, this has been really useful for us to do, for example, recommendation. I know that Etsy has used topic modeling to do recommendation. And at some point, Google showed me that they fit a topic model to a billion documents and a million topics. Something I couldn't have done. And we're using it as features for various things. So I started learning that topic modeling was used in different industrial applications. And then, of course, I started having students, and those students went and got jobs, and they brought also topic modeling to those jobs. So I had one student who went to Facebook quite early on and started using topic modeling to solve some of their problems.
Well, speaking of Google and big data, where are we now in terms of topic models and kind of the distributed parallel computing world?
Yeah.
What's the state of the art there?
Yeah, so I think another reason that topic modeling has become popular in industry is that here in academia, we've made a lot of progress in scaling up topic modeling and more generally scaling up statistical models. And I think that's a story worth understanding. So inside topic modeling, that story it looks like this. In 2010, Francis Bach and who was another student of Mike, same time as I was, he came and visited us at Princeton, and he gave a talk about how to do very large scale optimization, how to optimize a function with massive data sets. And we went out to a restaurant afterwards and we're talking, and I thought, you know, I think you could apply this to variational inference. And we decided to do it, and that resulted in a piece of work that was about using these new, well, actually these are old optimization techniques that have kind of new, fresh interest, using these old optimization techniques to scale up variational inference. And what that means, of course, is that we can scale up topic modeling. So before 2010, it was hard for us to analyze with our kind of modest academic clusters and things like that, to analyze 100,000 documents. That was a big deal for us. If we analyzed 100,000 documents, you know, that was a big piece of analysis. After that work, we now regularly can analyze 500,000 documents, 3 million documents, 5 million documents. And with a computer cluster, we can analyze billions of documents. So this was a big change. This changed the scale at which we could do these kinds of analyses. And further, our algorithm generalized to many different kinds of statistical models. Now, that's just a little story, part of a bigger story in machine learning of scaling up machine learning. And I think a lot of the interest in statistical machine learning and data science right now is thanks both to it being a rich field that provides tools that help us understand and exploit patterns in data, but also that we've all been working hard to bring it up to date to modern data set sizes. And this idea, which is called stochastic optimization, is one of the cornerstones of scaling up machine learning. And what's amazing about this is that that idea is from 1951. It's Robbins and Monroe, 1951, this little 8-page mathematics paper. That is the seed for why we can analyze all of these data sets now, why every technology company can run logistic regression at massive scale, why we can run topic modeling on a billion documents. It's thanks to Robbins and Monroe. And so there have been a lot of efforts getting back to topic modeling. We've been working on it. I know Alex Mola at CMU and Google has been working on it. There's been a lot of wonderful efforts on building distributed and streaming and scalable algorithms for topic modeling, some based on variational inference, some based on this other methodology that you mentioned, MCMC.
So actually, this is funny because I'm friendly with Ben Recht.
You know? Yes, Ben Recht is fantastic.
So he always
fantastic
scholar.
Yeah,
you know, at the end of the day, he said everything comes down to optimization, which is of course his bread and butter, right? So
that's right. And you know, I mentioned this old paper, Robbins Monroe. Ben Recht has a great handle on the history of optimization, and so the two stories of these statistical models like topic modeling becoming very expressive. We now have a language for expressing our assumptions about text. You know, we have authors and titles and abstract and clicks, and how do they all relate to each other in terms of what hidden quantities are governing these data that we want to analyze? You know, we have these beautiful abstractions, graphical models for describing patterns that we think live in the data. And then, thanks to optimization, we can discover those patterns, the realization of those patterns in our actual observations, by using these modern optimization techniques applied to objective functions that are derived from that model that we built. That's the story that I really like about probabilistic modeling, even more generally than topic modeling. And so some of the go ahead, Ben.
So the let me just clarify. So the algorithms, the MCMC algorithms that are distributed, my impression has been, as an outsider, is that they give good empirical results, but there's no theory. Is that correct? Because it's hard to parallelize.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
So there's little theory. Okay. So I think that that's a work in progress.
Okay.
Theoretically sound MCMC algorithms that parallelize. In variational inference, it's a little different because the idea behind variational inference is to first write your model down, then understand the inference problem, the main computational and algorithmic problem, as an optimization problem. Now you have an objective function and some parameters that you want to optimize. And now all of the theory of optimization is available to you. You can run all kinds of optimization methods, and you are doing what you said you would do, which is fit this objective function because it's a proxy for inference in the model that you cared about. But just to make it clear, MCMC has good theoretical properties in general as an inference method, and there's less theoretical understanding of variational inference statistically. So the optimization stuff is solid, but understanding what variational objective function means relative to the model that you care about, there are a lot of open questions in that theoretical sphere.
So in the space where topic model is applied, so I think of it as kind of, as you said, as you described, right? So there's two main things as far as I can tell. One is it's great for exploratory analysis, but mm-hmm. it's also great for generating features.
Yep, that's so, right. And so, that the second one, that's really my understanding from talking to people in the technology industry. We use it as an exploratory tool, but we also use it as a predictive tool to do things like build recommendation systems.
Right. So have there been competing strategies that have arisen since you've written that original paper? I guess deep learning is everywhere.
That's right. So I would say that, if you define the arms race as I'm going to generate features and then perform classification, one could sit down and compare the features you get from LDA to the features you get from deep learning methods to the features you get from some other method that you imagined. And I'm not sure.
I have to say, though, that the features you get from LDA, you can comprehend and you can explain it to, let's say you have a manager, right? So.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get at a little bit. So there's some accuracy numbers, and one of them does best. And so, in that type of contest, one of them is going to do best. I'm not sure which one would. But I really think that the problem of building a tool that takes in data and spits out predictions that does as best as possible, that's an important problem. It's a different problem than the one that topic modeling is trying to solve. Topic modeling, like you alluded to, is giving you an interpretation of the data. And I think that the success story for topic modeling that I find most compelling are the ones where people in the social sciences and in political science and in the digital humanities are using these tools to help them with their close reading of large archives of documents or in technology, you might use these kinds of tools to help you sort and visualize the results of a search query, right? These are problems that are independent of the kinds of problems that deep learning is trying to solve, which is focused more on, I've turned my problem into a classification problem. Given some input, I want to predict a class, what's going to do best. And these are different. Both are important. Interpretability and predictability are important, and they're also related. And I also think there's a lot of hope to combining these ideas, to building probabilistic topic models that use some of the ideas around multi-scale representations in deep learning to build interpretable deep representations of data. I don't see this all as being competitors. Rather, they are different stars in the constellation of machine learning methods that are out there now.
By the way, you point out, this is the thing that's really great about topic models, is it's accessible to a lot of people, and you really see it a lot in nowadays social sciences and humanities.
Yeah, and I work with a lot of social scientists now and talk and also people in the digital humanities, and it's amazing. And I also think that they are helping, this is a thing, but it's not static. It's people are building on it and studying it, and we're bringing it in different directions. I think, like I mentioned, a big phase transition for topic modeling was when we and others developed scalable topic models. It would have died down if we had never done that, I think, or if we as a community had never done that, because it wouldn't have been relevant. But I think that now the people in the digital humanities and the social sciences, they're pushing us in these other directions. They're pushing us in the direction of how do you build interpretable models, and how do you use the output of a topic model to say something meaningful about the documents? How do you visualize? These are, like you said earlier in the beginning of our conversation, these are UI, these are user interface questions and visualization questions and summarization questions. And they're important questions. They go back to people like John Tukey, who cared about exploratory data analysis and understanding the data from the output of statistical models. And I'm really excited about that work, because it's pushing us to answer these kinds of questions. What did I really learn about the data what can I really say about the data as an interpretation based on this model? And that changes the way you think about statistical models. Of course, the very end of that spectrum, this bottoms out in the ultimate kinds of questions, which are causal questions. Is there a causal question I can answer from text data? You know, that's a very controversial subject in academic circles, in statistics and in computer science and machine learning. But those are important things to grapple with.
Yeah, I need to get my head around, for example, the work of Judea Pearl. I need to understand what's going on in there.
Yeah, so that's something that's an interest in my group right now. And I would use the same language you did. We're trying to wrap our heads around that stuff. It's head spinning.
It seems important.
Right, these concepts of interpreting data, making causal hypotheses from data, and forming predictions from data, they're closely related to each other. And this is the cutting edge.
So it sounds like around 2010, the topic model community kind of got its hands around scale.
That's right.
So in over the next few years, let's say in the next 5 years, what are the most pressing things you think that the community still needs to address?
Right. So.
So well, I guess another dimension would be, how about real time?
Yeah. So that that's one thing I would mention. So, well, first I want to reiterate that I have my own ideas of what I want to work on next, what my group wants to work on next. But a lot of what's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years is going to come from, will be ideas that I couldn't predict. And I like that, I like that.
Yeah.
I'm always surprised and amazed by what I read when I read some of these great topic modeling papers. For our own research group, we're interested in a few things. So one is, and I think this is going to be important in the next 5 to 10 years, one thing we're interested in is bringing user behavior data into the world of analyzing text.
Okay.
The short story there being that, people are reading these documents, and you mentioned real time, right? You have a document collection, it's sitting on a server, and people are using it, right? People are clicking on these different O'Reilly books, and they are clicking on these different articles in your newspaper site. And like, we work with the archive, the scientific preprint repository. People click on archive papers. That gives us information about the people to form recommendations. That's a traditional task. But it also gives us information about the articles. So for example, you might find that there is a particular article, a scientific article, that has massive interdisciplinary appeal. And you can find that through looking at user behavior data, readership data. So I think that bringing readership data into the world of text analysis is something that's at the forefront. Speaking at even a higher altitude, I think that big questions that I've already mentioned, like causality, ideas in linguistics. So, topic modeling is almost has no linguistics inside it, right? It was based on assumptions that aren't derived at all from this rich field of linguistics, and bringing linguistic ideas and linguistic concepts into topic modeling, I think, is part of the next 5 to 10 years. And with that comes ideas like semantics, really grappling with meaning. And I also think there we need to grapple with, as I mentioned earlier, multi-resolution structures. Topics aren't simply patterns of words. They are themselves structured objects. And understanding what they are from data, I think, is an important question.
It sounds like you're going to start requiring a lot more domain expertise.
Yeah, so with the linguistics, right, that's domain expertise, right? Sit down with a linguist and ask her, tell me about the structure of language, and then ask yourself, how do I encode that in a statistical model? But that's really a microcosm of probabilistic modeling to help people understand their data in general. You sit down with a geneticist, with a neuroscientist, with a sociologist, with a linguist, understand the assumptions they want to make about the data, what hidden structures they think are at play, and then help them encode that into a statistical model, then use an algorithm like variational inference or MCMC to square their massive data set with those assumptions, and then use that to explore and predict. And that little pipeline is, I think, the way that we are going to be solving collaborative data science problems in the future. And building that pipeline is very important. This is not topic modeling. Topic modeling is a speck in this bigger world of probabilistic modeling. This is applied probabilistic modeling. And so what's needed is that scalable variational inference is automatic, that I can write a graphical model down and compile it into an algorithm automatically that takes data as input and spits out patterns that it finds in the data based on the assumptions I made. We need, as you said, real-time inference, which is that I don't have a data set, I have a data source. I have the Twitter fire hose, or I have my Facebook feed, or I have whatever, and I have a model that's sitting in between my interpretation of that stream and the stream itself. But traditional probabilistic models and traditional statistical models are based on you collected a data set, now it's time to analyze the data set. We're in a different paradigm now, thinking about what that means statistically and probabilistically, what it means to have streaming data in a rigorous way. That too is in the 5 to 10 year horizon.
This all sounds great. And actually, which brings me to how I want to close this conversation, which is you keep bringing up data science. And I know that you recently moved from Princeton to Columbia and are active in the data science program at Columbia. But I think, as you pointed out earlier, right? So one of the reasons the topic model was successful was you engaged the outside world. So here's to hoping that all the things you just talked about, you guys continue to engage the kind of industrial data science community in terms of putting code out, speaking at the industry events, and so on.
Yeah, no, and I've really...
Which brings me, you should come to Strata.
Oh, yeah, I would love to.
I'll invite you to Strata. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely love to, Ben. Yeah, no, I a lot of my research, you know, has benefited from my interactions with the technology industry. And, you know, half my students go into academia, half of them go into the technology industry. And when I sit down with my students that are in industry and hear about the problems, I walk away thinking, these are the most interesting problems I've heard of in a long time. Now, I think that that's changing. I think that now science is also grappling with interesting data science problems the same way that industry has been, because the scale of data has changed in science.
I think from what I remember, you also didn't jump from undergrad to grad school right away. You did work in industry.
So you have
an appreciation for that side of the fence, right?
So. Yeah. And right now we have a lot of relationships with different companies, and I advise some excellent companies and get a lot out of that. And it informs the kinds of problems that we work on. And I like speaking at events like Strata. Yeah.
Cool. Well, David Bly, this has been great. Thank you for taking this time to talk to me. And I'm sure our listeners will enjoy this episode.
Thanks, Ben. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. If you like the show, you can subscribe through TuneIn.com or SoundCloud or iTunes and never miss an episode.